I'm Gwendolyn Roberts Johnson, and I'm interviewing Mrs. Elsa Brown McGriff of 430 Birmingham Street, Bridgeport, Connecticut, on Friday, November 4th, 1983. Mrs. McGriff, I want you to tell me something about your early childhood. Where were you born?
I was born in Newton, Georgia, May 19, 1913, and we only lived in Georgia a short time. I was 4 years old when we came to Bridgeport. I'll let you ask the questions. I shouldn't lead it.
I want you to talk as much as you like.
I was 4 years old when we came to Bridgeport, and of course, I consider Bridgeport my home because I have none of the, you know, none of the characteristics of the South, of Georgia. And of course, I went to school in Bridgeport and grew up here.
Where did you live in Bridgeport?
When we first came to Bridgeport, we lived on Housatonic Avenue, just across the street from the Bridgeport Brass Company. And we lived there, three or four years. My father was a caster at Bridgeport Brass. And as children, we'd go over and sit, and they wouldn't allow you in there, but we would go to the gates and peep in and see them casting the brass.
It must have been interesting.
It was interesting to see that hot molten lava. And we were little devils, you know. We'd go over and peep in, and they'd have to run us away because my daddy worked there, and we'd go over and peep. And we lived there until we were approximately, I was school age. I started school there to kindergarten.
Yeah.
And it was Columbus School at the time. But we moved to Beardsley Street, 207 Beardsley Street in Bridgeport. My father bought this house. And from then on, of course, we went to Newfield School. Mm-hmm. And Newfield was quite prominent at that time. And Beardsley Street was quite a beautiful place at the time.
Yes, I heard that.
And from Newfield School at the time, it went to the sixth grade. And then you would be transferred to Lincoln School.
Were there all blacks in your neighborhood or were they?
No, it was a well-mixed neighborhood, mostly white at that time, but very few blacks.
Is your school still there? You said you went to what school?
Newfield School is still there.
Yes, yes.
And Lincoln School burned down a few years ago. Yes, but that's where I went until the ninth grade. At that time, you went to the ninth grade. And then Harding High was a brand new facility at the time. And from the ninth grade, you would go to Harding, don't you see?
Yeah. How was the student-teacher relationship like?
It was beautiful. It was very nice, really. Yet they were all white teachers.
Mm-hmm.
All white teachers, but in fact, in all Bridgeport, I don't think there was but one black teacher. I know about, and that was Marion Jennings came in, but that was later years, not when I was a child, not when I was going at that time. But then there was another one, I can't think of her name right now. She was a Whiting, I think, but they didn't have many black school teachers, no. And but we had a nice relationship between the teachers, because some of those old teachers, I think of what they taught me now. They were wonderful. And some of the old teachers have just died out. Miss Mooney, Miss Crotty, all those old teachers, they were just wonderful.
What about the student relationship, between students?
It was very good because, I tell you, there wasn't so much of you didn't notice black, white, in school, you were just schoolmates. At that time, we didn't have so much friction between the races. But of course, when you went to school at that time, you didn't you had your activities outside of the school, and you know, the black activities, and they had theirs. You didn't, when the school ended, that was it. You went home and you didn't pal around as much as people did. You didn't mingle as much as they do today.
Yes.
And therefore you didn't have any, a lot of trouble. We didn't.
Yes. What grade did you complete with?
The ninth.
What grade did you complete?
Ninth. And I was supposed to go to Harding. That's where that was the procedure at that time. But of course in my family there was a great deal of children. It was a big family. And I didn't, you know, it was depression. That was in 19, around 27 and 8. And it was a depression then. And I had to come out and work.
Were there many blacks in school with you?
Well, not the ratio wasn't like it is today, no. Especially over there. You see, in those days, we had the school system where if you live in this neighborhood, you go to that school. There, see, and the neighborhood I lived in was mostly white. So therefore you didn't have many colored, you know, not too many. So that was the way it was then. They call that the neighborhood schools.
What did you do when you were in school?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. Coming from a large family, I had to do a lot of work and helping at home. My mother was a laundress, and she did these clothes, you know, and because to help make out. And we would have to help her do. In fact, when I was 12 years old, I could iron a shirt better than I can today. You know, those beautiful white arrow shirts and those things. Well, I could iron better than I can today, because now I don't bother. But then my mother was very strict, and you had to do it just so. And I had to do an awful lot of work.
Ironing was an art then.
It was an art, and I had to do quite a bit of work, you know, all the way through.
Did you have many friends?
Yeah, well, we had our neighbors, children we grew up with, the children that we grew up with in the neighborhood. And all the colored people knew each other. They grew up in the neighborhood. We were, that sort of thing, because your mothers knew them, and, you know, yes.
What did you do for holidays? What kind of celebrations did you have?
Well, we had a nice time, believe it or not, even those depression days. You see, my mother being a good cook, and it made a difference because she could cook all these lovely things for the holidays, cake and pies. She was an excellent cook. And some of the neighbors were also, and we would have mostly eats, you know, on the holidays. We'd have, my mother would have, we'd have five or six cakes, you know, for the holidays and all that sort of thing. Pies, she'd make a half a dozen of them because of the large family, and she'd have her pantry just stocked with food like that. Even though it was a depression, we never, it didn't bother us like it did some people, you know, saying they didn't have things to eat. We always had plenty. Because we always worked. The whole family believe in work, and therefore you'd have, you didn't make the money you do today, but well, it counted up. You could get you know, in those days, a pound of pork chops for about 20 cents. Yeah, you look what you pay for a pound of decent pork chops today. So you see, it all depends on the management.
What did you do for activities and games? What kind of games did children play?
We had all kinds of dominoes and checkers. We played the old standard games, you know, and the family. My father played checkers, my mother played checkers, and you'd join in. And of course, in those days, you know, the heating situation and all that sort of thing, we'd all gather in the kitchen. And even friends come to visit, they'd come to the kitchen, you know. And you join in with these games, and it was the family was more important at that time than it is today.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me something about courting in those days?
That was funny. Yes. My mom, we'd have the fellows, you know, you'd meet these young fellows and they come visit, and my mother's being strict and those, they could have certain hours and certain times you could go out, go to a movie occasionally, because movies were 10 cents, you know, at that time. And we'd sit in the living room, because at that time, sometimes, you see, they would be cutting back on the heat. Oh. And therefore, the living room would only be used when you were entertaining somebody, you see what I mean? And so therefore, that had something to do with it, too, you know? Your house wasn't heated all over like it is today, because they had ways of shutting off the registers. And you know, mostly in the kitchen is where the entertainment centered around that. And we had our court, and you'd have certain days. You couldn't have boys over like people do today. You'd have them on certain days when they have the heat and different things and that sort of thing. But it was really nice. And we had quite a few boyfriends, we girls, and we had a lot of fun. In those days, believe it or not, I think they had just as much fun as you do today. Perhaps more.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Did you attend church?
Yes. Religiously, we had to go to. We belonged to Zion Church at the time. And of course, my family were Methodist. And we went down to Amy Zion. We grew up in Zion Church. And believe it or not, we lived on Beardsley Street and we walked every Sunday from the house on Beardsley Street to Zion Church.
Zion is where it is now?
Right where it is now. It's always been there.
That's a very old church, isn't it?
It is. Oh. It's been there all the time.
I hold that.
And we'd walk to the church and walk back.
Can you remember any of the ministers at that time?
Oh yes, we had Reverend Watson, Reverend Brown, Reverend Weller. Oh, he's a West Indian minister. He's a lovely man. And we had Reverend. Let's go back. Weller, Watson, Brown. I can't, see, because I've been in Bethel so long now that I've sort of forgotten.
Yeah.
I could if somebody refresh my memory.
What kind of recollections do you have about the Depression? I know you were very young during World War I, so you're going to talk about the Depression. What do you remember about the Depression?
It was a time when everybody had to work awfully hard to make ends meet because they just didn't have, you know. The money was short, jobs were short, and people worked, they didn't make very much. Now, I remember when I was young, people would work all day as a domestic and slept in, and they'd work on those jobs for $12, $15 a week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of them were 10. And they'd go out and do day work, like doing laundry for the day, or, you know, some housework. They only made $3, was wonderful.
Yeah.
$3 a day was wonderful. And in fact, all while I was a young girl, up until I was married, they made $3 a day in coffee.
Yes. Now, you just lived with your immediate family. You didn't have any extended family, like grandmother?
Yes, well, I only lived with my parents, of course, because my grandparents and all were from Georgia.
Yeah.
And I only knew of them.
Yeah.
In fact, now, my father's father, Jack Brown, was a minister, but he died when I was quite young.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know much about him. And in fact, there's quite a few ministers in our family, but I wasn't around them too much, you see, my parents. But now, some of my father's people lived in New Jersey. And of course, we saw them because they were close, you see. We could go over and see them. But the I saw my grandmother. She came up and visited when I was about 12 years old. My mother's mother, yeah. Mrs. Dunham. And she visited us when I was about 12 years old. And it was a rare, you know, occasion to have her. And Grandma Dunham, who was a wonderful cook, she brought in her trunk from down in Georgia. She had made about 6 cakes, different kinds, those Georgia cakes. And let me tell you, you've never eaten fruitcake or anything unless you've eaten a Georgia.
Yes, I'm a Georgian.
Fruitcake.
Yes.
Because of butter and everything, they made it right on the farm, you see. And it was just wonderful. And she had them in the trunk, wrapped into a linen-like, wrapped around these cakes and things in her trunk, and brought them up. And she brought all these goodies. Oh, and we kids, I always remember that because I knew she was a wonderful cook. She used to cook down there for the white families.
Yes.
And she was a very good cook. But I don't know too much about them. But I do know about my father's people in New Jersey.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, we've seen those aunts and uncles. I had one aunt that was a minister in New Jersey, my Aunt Carrie. And she was married to a minister, Reverend Owen, in New Jersey. And then I had another aunt, my father's sister, that married a minister, Reverend Coleman, in, she lived down in Elwood, New Jersey, right off down there. And so you see, those people I've been around a lot and know them very well, my Aunt Carrie, and I have some of their characteristics and all. Then I have my father's oldest sister, she's the oldest one in the family. She's 98 and a half now.
She's still old,
and living, but she's ill now. But up until she was 97, her other sister died, my aunt, May Willie died. And she began to fail. But up until then, if my aunt put on her clothes and walked into a building, she wore a wig, a black wig, and she walked into a building, she had beautiful clothes and she loved her clothes. She's one of these very dressy type women. She could pass for 55 or 60 years old, any place. Nobody would ever dream that my aunt, we call her Hootie, because she's so stuck up, you know, who?
Oh.
No. And, but she was, her name is Elvia.
And where does she live now?
She lives in Jersey City, New Jersey now.
Oh.
And if she lives to January 1st, she'll be 99, and she keeps telling when people tell her age, we say 98, she'll say 98 and a half,
mm-hmm.
because she's hoping to reach that 100. She really is trying very hard.
Yes.
Yes. And so I know that side of the family very, very well.
Can you tell me some of the things people did to try to survive during the Depression period?
Well, the most people could do was work. Just hard.
Did they
work.
Show any special talents for surviving?
Oh, yes. They're born with that, you see. I think their survival tactics come from back in slavery. Frankly, those people know how to survive. They know how to make ends meet. They knew how to spread a dollar, you know,
yes.
and make it count, make every penny count. And they taught us to be very thrifty. And today, I'm always out someplace looking for a bargain. Sometimes I waste money, but I'm out looking for a bargain, you know. So they really knew how to survive, and they knew how to do more than people do today. My mother could sew, cook, do, you see, they could do all of those things, where today people can't sew and embroider and do these things. Of course, you have to pay more if you don't know how to do these things, but if you know how to sew and how to cook and how to manage money, you can get by, you can survive. And it's a matter of knowledge, knowing how to do these little household tasks and chores, and how to make, stretch a buck. That's the idea, stretch a dollar. And people today have lost that. A lot of them have lost that because they never knew it, they never grew up with it. And they knew how, my mother knew how to take soup bone. and make a pot of soup, you see. But she made sure the soup bone had meat on it. She'd make a pot of soup and put little dumplings, little corn, she makes them, mix them with cornmeal and flour, dumplings on the top and all kinds of vegetables in the soup. That was a meal.
Yes.
Now she could feed her family on that, see. Yes. And she'd have a, always have a beautiful dessert, so you see the heavy dessert. And that made it fun. And you'd have all your, you see, you had to know. See, they knew about nutrition, they knew about that way back, you see. And we survived and we were very healthy.
Yeah. What about medical care, childbirth and that type of thing?
Well, in those days, now, I know, I've seen people have children in those days, not actually saw them, but I knew that they did. They would have the doctor or midwife come to the house, and the baby was born right in the house, you see, and the family was right there and everything. And they knew, they managed very well. They didn't have the care that people have today, and nurses, and of course they had the visiting nurses. At that time, visiting nurses were very, very, busy, because people would have the children, even with the midwives, the visiting nurses came in and took care of the baby and helped, you see, and come and help with the...
The babies were born in the home.
Yes, mostly in the homes, very few in, because I know I have brothers and sisters that were born right in the house on Beverly Street. And when my mother was ill, she'd send for my father on the job, and he'd go get the father. And he'd come home, and the baby, we'd hear it cry when it was first born, yeah.
And that wasn't uncommon for the doctor to make visits even for all the illnesses?
They would come out at 10 and 12 o'clock at night. You try to get a doctor today at that time. They come out and be with you when you birth the baby, and sometimes it's a ridiculous hour, you know?
Right.
And it was, that's all they did at that time, was the house called, the doctors were more of a friends than they are today, you know, they knew the family and they'd sit and talk and, until these things happen, and it was just like the old stories, you know, if you see the old movies of the doctor sitting talking with the family, it was the same idea.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, I know you were in Bridgeport during World War II. What can you tell me about that period? What do you remember most about the period of World War II?
World War II. Well, I'll tell you, that World War II was in, what year was that? 1940?
Started in the 30s, but America was involved in the 40s.
Yeah, it was in the 40s. Yes. And, of course, at that time, I was grown and married.
Yes.
So, of course, my husband didn't have to go, but he was working. He didn't have to go at the time. This is the second marriage for me. And my first husband was working at the time, and he didn't have to go at the onset of it.
So you married your first husband in World War II?
I married my first husband in 35. That was just before World War II.
And you were married to him how long?
And in 1939, we were divorced, 40. So you see, that's why I said he had to, he went into the army after that. But the second husband, John McGriff, that I married in 1940, didn't have to go because he had his age, and then my husband had had some illness. Anyhow, he didn't have to go, the second husband.
Mm-hmm.
And so he worked in the brass and the deferred, you know, they call that in the job, defense work. And of course, I went out and did some defense work too during World War II. And it was really World War II, prosperity began to come back. You know, all before that, it was terrible. Mm-hmm. Because when I was married to the first husband, it was awful. He worked at WPA, as they call it. $15 a week was all he made. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to struggle. And rents, of course, were much cheaper. You know, you got $18 rent, it was nice in those days. But If it hadn't been for the fact that everything was cheap, I don't know how people would have survived. But when World War II came in, everything began to skyrocket. Property began to be valued more. Yeah. And you had to pay more taxes. You had to, yeah. Everything escalated a little bit, you know, in World War II. And of course, you were making the money, but you were spending it also because the prices just escalated.
Now, during that time, Bristol was an industrial area.
It always
now,
was.
I know that people came from everywhere here.
Came here. And when they did, my husband and I purchased a house over on Lennon Avenue. And we had girls' room, you know, because it's hard for people to find somewhere to go. And they had come to our house on Beardsley Street, because when we were first married, we lived at 80 Beardsley Street. My husband bought that house. And we had rent tenants, of course, but we couldn't take in people, and people were coming looking for somewhere to stay. So we purchased that house on Lennon Avenue.
You're talking about you and Mr. McGriff?
Yes. Oh. We purchased that house on Lennon Avenue, and we had girls stay, single, young girls came in, and we had nothing but girls in there. And we ran that for about 5 years, 4 years.
Yes.
Yeah. And at the time, I did all the laundry and everything over there. And I had 12, 15 people staying there.
Yes, it was interesting. It was interesting.
And and I had a couple of couples, of course, there to help the guys put the place, because I, you know, we didn't live there. But I had to do all, I did all the laundry and everything, so I used to work.
Yes.
I had worked hard.
Yes, I understand there was a lot of money floating around Bridgeport at that time.
It was, and we made very good. And, well, it was really, that's when we got back out of the Depression, that war.
Yes.
Really brought us out of the Depression. Mm-hmm. Everything escalated, the taxes, everything went up.
Yes.
Just, you know.
Did you notice the change in race relations at that time?
Yes, there was quite a bit of change in race relations when so many people came in here. From the South and from various places, then the racial tension began.
Mm-hmm.
I think it brought more of it because, of course, they were flooding out Bridgeport with a lot of color, where they were, you know, bringing them in. And I noticed the tension, very much so. Yes.
Did black neighborhoods change?
They did, because colored people began to move into predominantly black neighborhood. That's what that's what spoiled the east side. You see, it was before, it was well mixed.
Oh, yes.
Then when the war came, the white moved out and the black moved in, and that's what changed Beardsley Street and all over in there. Stratford was all Jewish and Italians and Irish when I grew up.
Yes.
A few German and a few colored. It was well, you know, but then it became predominantly black.
Yeah.
They came in, and that's when tension really came about, when they made it predominantly black.
Uh-huh. Now, after the war, was work hard to get?
After the war, yes.
Yes.
Because everything began to go down, and you know, when things suddenly began to peter off, you know.
Yes.
Then, of course, that makes, and everybody's fighting to get in there, you know.
Yes.
And then that's where the tension was black and white, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the black was the last one hired, first one fired, and of course that always prevailed.
Yes. And were living conditions any different from what they had been?
Yeah, because you see, after the rooming situation, where so many people, you see, the houses, when I grew up in that neighborhood and all, the houses, like, you have four tenants, or if it was a four-family house, or if it was a three-family house, it was three tenants, three families.
Yeah.
That was all in there, and they probably had two children or one child.
Yeah.
But after the war, see, they'd gotten so used to piling up so many people, like, and some of the Puerto Ricans came, they'd be, where there was two people, there'd be 15 in that one flat, you see. So that's what made all the trouble and made so much, and that tore the house. You know, the house was already old, And you put 10 or 15 people on one facility where it was for one, even the electricity, the power wasn't sufficient because they're bringing in these ice box, bringing in this. See, they didn't have all that way back. They had ice boxes. That, those houses weren't wired, for these things. Okay. Those houses weren't, the furnaces, nothing was fixed to carry the load that was required when so many